You are listening to Larry Connors, USA.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
This is Larry Connors, USA. Larry Connors, USA. Larry Connors, USA, news and commentary.
July the 27th, 2020. One of the latest polls out again showing Biden is ahead of Trump by 7 points in a key battleground state of North Carolina. 7-point lead for Joe Biden. That's a state that Trump carried in 2016, North Carolina. The survey, a new NBC News Marist poll, found 51% of the registered voters say they would vote for Biden. 44% would back Trump. Now, that's one of many polls just being released. Does it mean anything? Are the Democrats buying it? Should you be afraid if you're not a Biden supporter? Or should you be really happy if you are? We'll get into that in more detail as we go through this hour. Biotech company Moderna now saying it has started dosing participants in a phase 3 clinical trial for a coronavirus vaccine. This phase 3 is part of a study, and we'll see how well it goes to help deal with, maybe deal with COVID-19, avoiding anyone having to go to the hospital and stop it short of even making someone sick. Dr. Fauci said results from the early stage clinical testing show this candidate is safe and produces an immune response. But, again, it's still in testing. In the meantime, a new survey finds that many churches shut down in March due to coronavirus don't really plan to open anytime soon. In fact, more and more pastors are saying we're not going to really have a full in-service worship till 2021. In May, none of the pastors had planned on closing through the end of the year. But now many more are saying, I'm probably not going to have a full in-person service again until 2021. 60th consecutive day and night of protests in Portland. And not far from the scene of one of the events, police found a bag of rifle ammunition and Molotov cocktails. But of course, keep in mind, these are all peaceful demonstrators. And I'm sure peaceful demonstrators were the ones who torched 4 police cars in Philadelphia. All 4 parked in different parts of that city. Just sitting there, unoccupied. Now police are being told in Philadelphia, do not leave your vehicle somewhere where someone else could get to it and you can't watch it. Another violent weekend in Chicago. 59 shot, 3 fatally. And we're waiting to see exactly when federal agents will be sent into Chicago, possibly tomorrow. And Mayor Lightfoot, who had originally been against that, said, well, if they're just coming to help us deal with crime, okay. That's the intent. In the meantime, in Long Island, New York, over the weekend, more than 1,000 packed Eisenhower Park. It's a nonprofit group, Law Enforcement Officers Weekend, sponsoring the rally. A thin blue line and American flags for Back the Blue rally. Visitors from across Long Island, New York City, police departments, members of the community, and more showing up. Wanted to show their support for those in blue, our law enforcement. The Nassau County Police Benevolent Association union leader said, we don't have these kinds of problems in Nassau County. We have a tremendous relationship in all of our communities. We fostered these relationships, and hopefully we can hold it that way. You're going to be joined later in this hour by a criminologist on his idea of how we can maybe take police off some streets and still be safe. Price of gold hitting a record high, $1,943 an ounce. Partly because of the coronavirus pandemic and U.S.-China tensions. Oh, and get ready for this. Iran has another aircraft carrier. No, it's like the one they built in 2015. Another aircraft carrier built out of wood, 650 feet long, with 16 fake fighter jets on the deck. They're going to pull it out somewhere where they can then shoot it up, say, this is what we would do to an American aircraft carrier. Of course, there are no weapons on this wooden aircraft carrier. It will not be shooting back at them. But they think they could do this with a U.S. carrier. Good luck with that.
Larry Connors, USA, news and commentary.
Tom Wellington and his staff at Wellington Environmental have certainly been busy over the last several weeks, making sure businesses and hospitals and nursing homes are clear of COVID-19. As you begin to reopen, try to restart your business, I would encourage you to contact Wellington Environmental. I'll give you a phone number in a moment. They can come in, assess the situation at a very reasonable cost, and make sure your facility is clear of COVID-19. And even after you're open, if something comes up and you're not sure, you want to contact Wellington Environmental. And not only for COVID-19, for any other threat, mold, any toxic situation. Wellington Environmental, 314-644-4930. 644-4930. In business for 30 years, you know they're doing it right. Be well with Wellington Environmental. I want to thank my friends at John Bill Roofing for sponsoring this segment of Larry Connors USA. John Bill Roofing, covering homes, businesses throughout the Midwest with the best quality, lowest price. John Bill Roofing. Call 1-800-NEW-ROOF. 1-800-NEW-ROOF.
This is Larry Connors, USA.
Larry Connors, USA.
What I hope does not happen is that the Biden campaign becomes intoxicated with the polls, which are at this point much better than they were 100 days out for Clinton and Trump. And in fact, they were tied in some states, only 1 point difference, and others 100 days out. It's much different now. But if they are enticed by the polls, I think it would be to their detriment.
The words of Al Sharpton saying all these polls are looking good for Biden, but he's saying don't be enticed. He's telling Democrats, I hope they don't buy into them fully. Because we saw similar polls this far out in 2016 as Hillary was apparently going to demolish Donald Trump. Remember that? And again, these polls continue to come out showing all kinds of lead. A CNN polls released over the weekend. Florida leading, Biden leading, I should say, in Florida, 51% to Trump's 46% support. Arizona, Biden 49, Trump 4 points behind at 45%. In Michigan, Biden with 52%, Trump at 40%. And again, Biden supporters are pretty excited about these. But at the same time, those inside are saying, be careful here. And I mentioned to you earlier in news and commentary, a North Carolina survey showing a state that Trump carried in 2016, North Carolina, again a key battleground state, and according to a new NBC survey, Biden is leading Trump in that state by 7 points. An historian, John Meacham, was warning Democrats over the weekend. He said, yeah, you've got Biden leading Trump double digits nearly every poll 100 days before Election Day. And then he said what is really at stake here. A lot of people who will vote, quote, for the incumbent, in other words, for Trump, are not telling the pollsters. And he said, Biden's campaign needs to be careful about this. This is still a long ways to go. 100 days, endless, an eternity in a campaign. Not the least because of all the problems we see at the nation at this point. COVID, the rioting. The historian did say there is something, quote, about the American character that prevents the country from running in one direction with one party very long. And he did say, yeah, Trump has upended many of the norms. But again, do they or should they buy into these surveys and these polls? Al Sharpton was asked, well, in addition to the polls, what are, and I hear you saying that we should not simply buy the survey and believe it's all going to be good and locked up for the Democrats. What are you hearing on the ground?
I'm hearing on the ground it's better than 16, but it still has a distance to go. There needs to be more direct outreach, and there needs to be a more emphasis on policies, both in the black and brown communities. I think the article you referred to, I read as well, talks about in Florida particularly, there's a problem with Latino voters in terms of some on-the-ground organizing and outreach. Now, given the pandemic, it becomes even more challenging, but you need to put effort over the challenge. And clearly in the black community, if you had had more outreach in 16, I think that Michigan as well as Pennsylvania, probably Wisconsin could have been a different story.
But again, in some of those cases, Hillary decided, I don't need to do any more in that state. It's all locked up. Counting on the vote is going to be there. Trump got 8% of the black vote in 2016. You've heard Dr. Gerard Lamero on the same program say he's expecting him to be well into double digits this time. A phenomenal number. If Trump can get anywhere near double digits, 11, 12%, I don't see much chance for the Democrats to hold on at that point. And you heard the mention from Sharpton about the issues in Florida with Hispanics. There are a lot of problems developing in Florida. In fact, some of the Hispanic organizers working to elect Joe Biden, the ones working on his election team, sent a 7-page letter to the Florida Democrat Party claiming this is a toxic work culture. And they are saying their own campaign, the campaign for Biden, is suppressing the Hispanic vote in Florida. There were 8 different allegations against the campaign, quote, including mistreatment of field organizers, relocating trained staff members without explanation, lack of organizing resources, taking on volunteers who are then left in limbo. Staffers also saying the coordinated campaign lacks key infrastructure and has a toxic work culture that's hurting morale among these staffers on the ground. These are, again, the Latinos working for Biden in Florida. In fact, the letter pointed out 4 of 5 Spanish-speaking organizers were moved to North Florida, were Puerto Rican. They're not Hispanic. They're Puerto Rican. And they said that will not necessarily go well with Mexican descent Floridians. And they say this is all suppressing the Hispanic vote by also removing Spanish-speaking organizers from Central Florida. In fact, the paper noting that despite 100 days left in the race, the workers demand better conditions, and they're negotiating with a union. They're stepping forward and saying the things are so bad inside the Democrat Party inside Florida, we might need to form a union. Now, again, a survey in Florida, Quinnipiac, shows that Biden has a 13-point lead over Trump. Trump did win Florida narrowly in 2016, 49% to 47.8%. And another survey is also pointing out where Biden and Trump stand when it comes to racial backgrounds and demographic breakouts. According to the NBC News Wall Street Survey, made July 9th through the 12th, Trump will get 6% of the black votes if the election were held on that date. 6%, 2% less than last time. And Biden will get 80%. But Sharpton says there's still a problem inside the Biden camp. He said it's the lack of enthusiasm. And Sharpton's acknowledging what's going to change everything, either make it better or worse, will be the candidate Joe Biden selects for a running mate.
The other thing, let's not forget, that could be a very big enthusiastic reaction, or it could deflate some reaction, is who he chooses as a running mate and whether or not that running mate energizes in the black and brown community, whether they be black or not. I've said I'd like to see a black woman, but I think some others can even energize. A running mate could be something that either accelerates or deflates where Biden is in the black and brown communities in terms of turnout.
That's going to be big for Biden. Now, again, if you go back to that NBC News Wall Street Journal survey I was reading a moment ago, Biden's got 80% of the black vote. Trump has 6%. But that means 14% in the win. Latino vote. It's even worse for Biden. A lot of folks would have thought Trump's got to be running away with Latino. I mean, Biden's got to be running away with Latino vote for everything Trump has been doing, fighting illegal immigration. And yet, speaking of illegal immigration, they want to say simply he's against immigration and fearing the brown menace, as they like to say. Well, Biden is polling only 67% of the Latino vote. Trump, 22%. If you break it out on the ages of 18 to 34, the numbers are very close to the Latino vote. Trump has 23%, Biden 62%, losing 5 off the Latino vote, 62%, ages 18 to 34. Now, what about the gender difference, women? Biden is slipping again, and Trump is accelerating again. And obviously the surprise of a lot of people. This NBC News Wall Street Journal survey shows that 35% of the women questioned would vote for Trump. 35%. We've been told repeatedly he's losing every woman vote, not going to have any of them. And of course, Hillary Clinton, the last time around after losing, blasted any woman who voted for Trump, saying, "You're just stupid. You only did what you did in a vote for Trump because your husband or your boyfriend told you that's how you should vote." That didn't go over very well with women who say, "I think for myself." Biden's only showing 58% support. And you get those with a degree. Anyone with a degree. White, I should say. White and has a degree. White women with a degree. 38% of the women are in favor of Trump. 53% for Biden. Sharpton's right in the sense that the running mate that Biden selects is going to have a lot to do with the enthusiasm and how much support he's going to get. He's fighting on so many levels, though, because everyone, even inside the party, acknowledges he probably will not serve an entire 4 years if he is elected. There's already concern about that. So the person selected as his VP, if he were indeed elected, that person could be president within 2 years, maybe less. And be it a woman, white, brown, black, will it make a difference to a lot of folks? And on top of that, how much of a Trojan horse is Biden as he continues to carry water for Bernie Sanders and the radical left? Sharpton, though, says really the key that has got to be dealt with, that would be the black vote. Because if Trump pulled 8% last time in this latest Wall Street Journal NBC survey, shows him getting 6%. Trump and the black vote are very much in play.
He will be the rock bottom vote getter among blacks in Republican Party history. No one has, in my view, and I'm not talking just from my position, but in people that I talk to on the ground, in the churches, just people stopping me in the street all over the country as I travel, no one has, in my opinion, has energized such emotion and passion that people are willing to go out and vote and do whatever they have to do to vote against him. I think the biggest weapon for Joe Biden in terms of energizing black turnout and brown turnout is Donald Trump. He has worked hard at it, and he will earn when he gets Election Day.
And he's also saying in that same breath that Trump is alienated. He's trying to say alienated so many blacks and browns that he will get the rock bottom numbers of any candidate when it comes to the black vote. And yet, last time he got 6%, basically saying, just what do you got to lose? Go with me. Or 8%, yeah, last time. And they're forecasting only 6% this time. We're still 100 days out. A lot can happen. We'll find out. Take a break. When we come back, a professor of criminology and law says he thinks he has a promising alternative when it comes to policing high crime areas and high crime streets. Will it be effective? How does it work? Stand by, please.
You can connect with Larry on Twitter at LarryConnorsUSA.
This is Larry Connors, USA.
Larry Connors, USA.
Do precisely what you're doing. And don't listen to all these willy-nilly, namby-pamby Democrats that are panicking. He is running a smart campaign. He's doing what he needs to do. When he has to, he's drawing a contrast. I really think that I don't really have a complaint.
That's James Carville, who had been the political strategist for Bill Clinton. And he says that Biden is doing exactly what he needs to be doing, precisely what he should be doing. Or as James says, don't listen to no namby-pamby Democrats that are panicking. You don't need to panic. You're just fine like you are. By that, stay in the basement. That's a fear of a lot of Democrats. He's still down in the basement and not really coming out. Using the COVID-19 distancing as an excuse not to get out in the midst of the public. You know, 60 Minutes, Chris Wallace on Fox News had an interview a week ago Sunday with President Trump. They extended the same time this last Sunday for Joe Biden. They could obviously set up in a secure area and everybody'd be properly protected. But Biden wouldn't do it, doesn't want to take part in such an extended interview. Why? Is it because he probably can't hold his own against Trump? Can't really stay on message for something like an hour and a half plus? I think the full Trump sit-down with Wallace ran close to 4 hours, maybe not quite that long. But, I mean, that's a long time to sit there and continue to take question after question. But Carville thinks that Biden's doing the right thing. And he said, all these Democrats are getting a little panicky. Just do what you're doing. And in fact, the other concern many have had is that Biden will not be capable of debating. And he'll probably end up pulling out of the debates, deciding, I can't do it. I can't get up there on stage with Trump. I will lose, and I'll lose terribly. No, Carville's got his own opinion about that as well.
I think Joe Biden is doing just fine. I think his campaign is really smart, and there's just a lot of hand-wringing. It's not 2016. It's 2020. And you can't run like you ran the last election. I think he'll be fine. If if there is a debate, sure, he'll be glad to do it. As I point out, some of the best debaters in presidential history in this Democratic field. I mean, Bernie Sanders, the most disciplined candidate I've seen, Elizabeth Warren, Mayor Pete. I mean, these are world-class debaters, and he did just fine. He's going to do fine. I'm not worried in the least bit about Joe Biden. I'm not worried in the least bit about his campaign.
I'm glad James not worried, but I will tell you this, and he knows the difference. In those primary debates with all the rest of the Democrats on stage, Biden didn't have to defend everything every second. It was not just two on stage. It was a host of folks so he could take time to think about before it came to him and either get into it or stay out of it. When it's just him and Trump, how can he handle that one-on-one? But here's something else Carville says. He's suggesting that Trump might be looking at a landslide defeat. He said, Trump's going to have to conclude with Jared Kushner. Do I go ahead and run and risk being destroyed or resign? In other words, getting out of the race. And he points out to what happened in 1932. Roosevelt defeating Hoover, 472 electoral votes to 59. So James Carville is convinced it's possible that if it becomes apparent before Election Day that Trump would lose, he'll just give up. Yeah, I don't buy that. Our criminal law professor coming up.
You can email Larry at LarryConnorsUSA@gmail.com. LarryConnorsUSA@gmail.com.
Hi, I'm local tax attorney Lance Drury, and I've represented hundreds of individuals and small businesses in disputes with the IRS. So if you've been contacted for past due tax debt or haven't filed taxes in a while, contact me, Lance Drury. And because each client's case is unique, we'll meet face-to-face and go over your tax situation in detail. Together, we'll develop a strategy to resolve your tax issues. I'm experienced, I know your rights, and I'll give you honest answers. Under my 8-point plan, my firm will file the necessary forms needed to resolve your issue with the IRS, and you won't have to worry about talking to their agents. I'll negotiate on your behalf to get you the lowest settlement allowed by law. At the Lance Drury Law Firm, we want to make sure that you're satisfied with the outcome. So call me now, tax resolution attorney Lance Drury, 314-238-7360, or go to LanceDrurylaw.com.
The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely upon advertisements.
You ain't nothing but a hound. It's Snoop and I'm a dog. You ain't nothing but a hound.
This is Larry Connors, USA.
Larry Connors, USA.
My next guest wrote a piece for The Hill, an opinion piece on a promising alternative to policing high-crime streets. Now, if someone's got an alternative, let's take a look at it. He is a professor of criminology, law, and society at George Mason University, also a professor of law and criminal justice at Hebrew University, David Weisberg. Glad to have you on board, sir.
Glad to be here, Larry.
Let me begin with, you were in Jerusalem now, is that correct?
Yes, I am in Jerusalem now.
Now, is that part of the Hebrew University study group that you're doing or leading, or is that just something else at this point?
Well, I'm a professor both at George Mason and at Hebrew University, so I go back and forth. So the corona period is inhibiting my travel a bit.
Right, I would imagine that. Before we move into my main issue, I would be interested in the difference you see in the criminology and how it's treated in Jerusalem and versus the U.S.?
Well, I think that it's surprisingly similar, actually. The Hebrew University, like many Israeli universities, is very much part of the world community of scholars, and therefore the kind of criminology you do here is similar. It's also the case that criminal justice institutions like the police also have great deal of similarity. They're democratic policing institutions, as in the States.
Now, a lot of folks would look at Jerusalem and think, well, that's a true, and not in a derogatory sense, a true police state versus what we have here, that if you have crime on the street, you have not just Hebrew police, but Hebrew Jewish troops involved. Is that an incorrect assumption?
No, that's an incorrect assumption. Just like in the States, it's civilian or it's police officers that handle crime in the streets, etc. The military handles crime outside the country. or not crime, but terrorism and war and things of that sort.
Right. Okay. So let's get to this piece you wrote for The Hill. As I said, I found it interesting just on the title itself. One of the things you point out, and before we get into the alternatives to begin with, one of the observations that you point out as to how crime is typically concentrated in a small number of streets in any particular city. I'll let you have the floor, sir.
Sure. There's been a let's call it a misunderstanding both among criminologists and the public about crime. People tend to think there are bad communities. You walk in there, every street is a problem. And in other communities, none of the streets are a problem. It's not that way at all. In fact, in my research, I found that about 5% of the streets in larger cities produce 50% of the crime. About 1% of the streets produce 25% of the crime. What's amazing about that, by the way, it's true of cities across the country and even across the world. New York, Seattle, Tel Aviv, and other cities have similar concentrations. I call it the law of crime concentration. But what's important about that is it says that crime is concentrated on a relatively small number of streets in a city. And by the way, importantly, they're not all in the same neighborhood. In other words, let's call it them. The chronic crime hotspots are often spread throughout a city. And even in we usually consider the sort of, quote, worst parts of town, in those parts of town, most of the streets have little or no crime. And that creates a very different sense of both what we ought to be doing and how we think about the problem. In other words, the problem is not whole areas, the bad part of town. The problem is specific streets on the bad part of town. And it also has an... Go ahead, Larry.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, on some extent, we know that police task force will go in and they target one hot zone, one area. It may be more than one street in a neighborhood, but one spot itself. Now, when you say one street, you don't literally mean the length of that block of that street, because obviously it does, I assume, have fallout on either side of the street and a couple streets over in some cases.
Well, it's surprisingly so that it's often just one street. Sometimes it's a very small cluster of streets. But that's very different. A reporter once called me on the phone and was telling me about an intervention in a large city and said that, well, the chief is going after the hot spots, and the hot spot was a whole area of town. And that's not only inefficient, because it means you're spreading police resources a lot more meagerly than you should be, but it's also problematic, because policing can be very difficult. It can infringe on rights of citizens because you're stopping people, questioning them, and things of this sort. And that ought to be focused in very, very small places where you need it, not across whole areas. It's not when departments send large number of police across a whole area of town. That is a very bad idea, both in terms of efficiency, but also in terms, I think, of citizens.
All right. One other point of clarification. When we say 5%, it's staggering numbers, 5% of streets producing 50% of crime in some areas. The 5% of those streets, that's where the crime occurs, or that's where the criminals exist and then go out from there to commit the crime beyond those?
No, that's where the crime occurs. It's amazingly consistent. The way this happened for me is I did a study in Seattle, and I found about 5% of the streets in Seattle produced 50% of the crime. And that was true pretty much year to year over 16 years, even though crime generally was going down. But the same number of streets were responsible for 50% of the crime. Then I did a study in Tel Aviv, and what do I find? 50% of the crime is at 5% of the streets. Then I went to New York City. And what do I find? That 50% of the crime is at 5% of the streets. So I call that the law of crime concentration. And it seems to be consistent across countries in South America, in the UK, in Australia, and other places where research has been done. And that provides a great opportunity, because it says if we can focus our crime prevention resources, we can focus larger dosage on a smaller number of streets.
Well, let's focus on that part, because if we're talking about defunding police and not having as many available, what is an alternative to policing those high-crime streets?
Well, I want to say first that I also chaired a panel in the National Academy of Sciences. We looked at proactive policing. And it's important to note that when police do focus on hotspots, they generally have a deterrent effect. So police can be effective at hotspots. But you're right. Today, people are talking about defunding the police. People have strong negative feelings about police activities that are intensive, etc. So the question becomes, when people start talking about defunding the police, what can they do? Well, I think the idea of hotspots is not about policing. In other words, the idea that crime is focused on a relatively small number of streets in a city provides an opportunity not only for policing, but also for other sorts of interventions that might reduce crime. Now, what I suggested in the piece that you're talking about in the op-ed, I talked about increasing the extent to which citizens on the street feel trust for each other and are willing to get involved in solving problems. I've just finished a large study for the National Institute of Health looking at these streets, these hotspot streets, and their characteristics and the people who live on them. And what I found, in, which has spurred me in this direction, is that on hotspot streets, citizens are much, much less likely to trust their neighbors than in cold spots, places with little or no crime. This is called, some people call this collective efficacy, the ability of people to be able to do something about problems in the street and their willingness to get together with others and do that. And what it turns out is on hotspot streets, the collective efficacy is much lower. So my idea is, if that's true, then maybe we ought to be focusing on these hotspot streets and bring alternative interventions there. Maybe social workers, community organizers who can help the people in the street deal with some of the problems in the street on their own. Because well, they don't want the police dealing with every problem.
I think a lot of folks would go along with that aspect of it, that the, if you could have that effort in these communities, and if the neighbors will trust and work with each other. But the, as you know, the fear in many of these communities, maybe the same streets you're talking about, is, yeah, I would like to do that, but they know where I live, and they'll come back here.
Yeah, I think, Larry, that's a very good point. But the idea here is not to get rid of the police. When I think about providing other sorts of resources, I actually would prefer that you didn't defund the police. I think the police play a very important role in reducing crime on problematic streets, especially. What I'm suggesting is that there are many problems that citizens on their own can handle without bringing the police. And it might be better, because the police are law enforcement officers. They have guns, they have clubs.
Give me an example of something they could handle that normally, let's say if you got a domestic disturbance, police called, or you have neighbors try to interfere?
Well, domestic disturbance is not something I think the citizens ought to be handling on their own.
Okay, so what would be an example?
There are many problems that come to the attention of the police, from loud noise to a neighbor that makes a lot of noise to somebody mentally ill in the street. At the moment, the police tend to get a lot of these responsibilities, and they may not be the best people to handle them. In the model I'm thinking about, we'd help people on a street to get together, to talk to each other, to look out for their neighbors, to call other agencies. What agency to call when there's someone mentally ill in the street? The knee-jerk reaction, of course, I think for most people is 911. But maybe that's not the best agency.
I think you got a great idea there if it's actually followed through. But I mean, it's like telling people, don't call an ambulance to go to the hospital just because you want transport somewhere, which cities have been battling forever. And you're right, the first knee-jerk is call police. But in the last 30 seconds, sir, how are you going to get people instilled to buy into it and make it work? The idea sounds great, but can we achieve it?
Well, I think the idea here is with social workers or community organizers, you can help people to sort of become empowered to be able to do things. There's already a project in Seattle where the city government is playing a role, a student of mine calls it, as a super controller. In other words, opposed to the police taking all the responsibility, the government itself, the city, plays a coordinating role in which it manages social workers and others and the police to try to help to solve problems. I think that this is an unexplored area. If we want to talk about hotspots policing, a colleague and I developed the first hotspots policing experiment in the early 1990s. We've had a lot of time to think about and develop the kinds of strategies police can use to do something about a problematic hotspot.
Well, obviously, I would hope
but in this case,
we're running out of time, I would obviously hope police and communities would pay attention to what you did and see what value they can and how they can apply it, and I'm sure many are already. I want to thank you very much, Professor, for your time, especially giving us your time while you're at work in Jerusalem as well, sir.
Sure, Larry. Good luck.
You bet.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it. Dave Weisberg, Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society at George Mason University and also Hebrew University. Stand by, please.
You can follow Larry on Larry Connors USA Facebook. Larry Connors USA Facebook.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel aglow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
This is Larry Connors, USA.
Larry Connors, USA.
Well, the casket of Congressman John Lewis has been carried into the Capitol Rotunda by an honor guard. John Lewis, civil rights leader, in addition to being a legislator, first elected to Congress in 1986, 17 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives. He was one of the big six leaders of groups who organized the 1963 March on Washington. The last surviving member at the time of his death. He had so many key roles in the civil rights movement, and all of it to help in legalize racial segregation in the U.S. In 61, he became one of the 13 original freedom riders. Seven whites, six blacks, determined to ride from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans in an integrated fashion. Now, at the time, several southern states were still enforcing laws prohibiting black and white riders from sitting next to each other on public transportation. Some of you might not even know about that. You might have heard that, yeah, there was a separation, but riding on a bus, you wouldn't do that, couldn't do that. That was true. That's the way it was at that time. Freedom riders also exposed the passivity of the government when it came to violence against minority citizens who were simply doing nothing more than carrying out their wishes. They weren't really violating any law other than the mores of that particular society and culture at that time. The federal government had allowed the Alabama police to protect the riders or trusted them to do it, but they didn't do anything. The Kennedy administration had to step in and ask for a cooling off period with a moratorium on the freedom rides because Lewis and others were often beaten by angry mobs, arrested at times, taken to jail. In fact, at age 21, he was the first of the Freedom Riders to be assaulted while in Rock Hill, South Carolina. He had tried to enter a whites-only waiting room. Two white men attacked him, injuring his face, kicking him in the ribs. See, that was systemic racism. Do parts of that still exist now? Maybe in some minds, but not in a system. We have gotten past that, but we still need to learn from this kind of past. At one time, he was imprisoned for 40 days in the Mississippi State Penitentiary because he participated in Freedom Riders activity in that state. In 63, when the head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, stepped down, Lewis then was elected to take over. He's already respected for his courage and his tenacity. By this time, he'd already been arrested 24 times for nonviolent movements in equal justice, pushing for equal justice. Nonviolent. Didn't throw anything, didn't assault anyone, didn't try to even spit on anyone. Just absolutely nonviolent. And keep in mind, you're in these rides, these freedom riders were sometimes beaten with baseball bats, chains, lead pipes, stones, then thrown into jail by police. He said, at one point, I thought I was going to die. I was left lying at the Greyhound bus station in Montgomery, unconscious. And that's when they began to back down. And, of course, he also coordinated much of the efforts for Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964. In 1965, he, along with others, were those crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. They were met by police on the other side and white supporters of the police, beating and attacking them and arresting them. The same bridge, Sunday. The same bridge Sunday. The bridge where he walked arm in arm with civil rights and political leaders at that time. His coffin on a horse-drawn wagon was taken across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. As a wagon approached the bridge, members of the crowd shouting, "Thank you, John Lewis." Good trouble. That was a phrase he often used. Get in some good trouble, as he described his tangles with white law enforcement. Some were singing the civil rights anthem, "We Shall Overcome." That wagon rolling over a carpet of rose petals stopped atop that bridge over the Alabama River, so family members could walk behind it. And on the south side of the bridge, when they got to the other side, where Lewis was beaten by Alabama state troopers in 65, family members placed red roses that the carriage rolled over to mark the spot where Lewis and others had spilled their blood and he had suffered a head injury. A military honor guard lifted his casket from that horse-drawn wagon and placing it into a hearse. Alabama state troopers, including African-American Alabama state troopers, were there, saluting and honoring John Lewis and others who had crossed that bridge on that bloody Sunday 55 years ago. Part of our history. Don't forget that. We'll be back tomorrow. Book it.
This is Larry Connors USA.
Larry Connors USA.
Thank you for listening to Larry Connors USA. Please listen to previous and future podcasts.